Welcome to Conversations. I'm your host, Doug Doohan, and joining me this segment is Jonathan Fanning, author of the book Creativity Unleashed. Join us as we look at issues that affect us here at home in our community and across the nation. Today, we're going to talk about implementing and nourishing creativity in our lives. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, yeah. Great to be with you, Doug.
Yeah. So let's just dive directly in. Why, in your opinion, is creativity important, and how does creativity manifest in ways that people may not expect?
Very good questions. Yeah, so part of my journey into digging into this topic was I wanted some things that didn't exist, and I wanted results that most people didn't get. And I would say that's a piece of the answer. You know, if you're totally happy with everything going on in your life, everything going on in your family, everything going on in your finances, everything going on in your ability to impact the community, the world around you, then you might not need any more creativity. Unless the world changes underneath your feet, you know, somebody pulls the tablecloth out from under you, which happens over and over. Mm-hmm. It's every aspect of our lives, creativity affects. It's really, creativity is a lid on everything. It's a lid on relationships, on communication, on travel, on impact, on finances, on career, on will you start the business or not? And if you do, will you get customers? Will it be an amazing business or an okay business? And, that's where I started. I thought I have okay results and I want something different.
I think that, like what you say with finances, with relationships, I mean, we talked about this before we started the actual conversation, is that I think people get stuck in the box of thinking that creativity is just artistic endeavor. And you're saying that it's completely the opposite. It's a part of everything.
Oh, it's a part of everything. Sure. Yeah. I was speaking on this topic in Philadelphia, big conference. And one of the vendors that sponsored the conference comes up to me and says, you know, I think I do a lot of what you're talking about really well. And I said, oh, that's great. Good. And she says, in my company, like, what would you suggest I do to have more creativity? And I said, well, I don't know. Talk to me about some stuff. She tells me a little bit about her business. And I said, how about this? Do you support any causes? And she said, oh, yeah, I have a couple that really matter a lot to me. And I said, well, here's a place for creativity. Double your impact on that cause this year. And she looked at me like, oh, yeah, that's a good one. And I said, so often the quality of our lives hinges on the quality of the questions we pursue. And we tend to pursue a lot of okay questions, mediocre questions, survival questions, yesterday questions. You could call them uninspiring questions. And that question of how do you double your impact on that cause that matters a lot to you? She said, wow, I'm thinking like it's not just giving them some more money, but I probably need to free up more of my time from my business to do that. And it just, you know, it was like one of those things where it's a lid. Creativity is a lid on life.
It's the same thing with like with charitable donation. Okay, so people often find out that I do a lot of charity work and they're like, well, that must be very expensive. And I say, there's other ways to give. I volunteer a lot. I show up. I offer my services versus just financial. And that is a part of that creativity is people box themselves into things thinking that one thing is one thing when really there's options. Where then do you think creativity comes from and how can we nurture it? Essentially, are we dispelling the myth that you're just born with it?
Yeah, there's, Doug, there was a study done, and it's part of the reason I wrote the book and spend so much time on this topic. There was a study done, NASA funded it, you know, the people that landed on the moon in the 60s. Mm. And they did this study trying to figure out, you know, where are people, like, can you filter out creativity? Is it just a personality trait or you're born with it? And they found that five-year-olds scored off the charts. Essentially, they studied about 2,000 five-year-olds, and they found that 98% of five-year-olds scored off the charts. They called them creative genius. But by the time they're 20 or 25, only 2% scored off the charts in creativity. And the guy that ran the study, this guy named George Land, he said at the end of it, I realized, like, the one thing I learned is that non-creative behavior is learned. Which is an incredibly powerful statement. It says essentially, like, you were a genius in creativity when you were five, and something changed. You know, and all of us went through it. You know, so you're basically the process of unleashing creativity more in your life, but also in if you run a company or if you coach a sport or you teach in a school, you want more creativity in your own life, but also in people around you. it can be the unlearning can be relearned. So there's a process. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, as a parent, as a boss, I mean, are we inhibiting creativity in others? And if so, how is that happening?
Yeah, the answer is yes. The answer is yes in a big way. You know, so I started studying over 20 years ago, actually, now I started studying the most creative people and leaders and organizations, but not just looking at their whole picture, but looking at the moments when they were bringing out massive amounts of creativity and the moments when they were stifling it, because we all go through this kind of oscillation. Same age group, age five, little kids ask hundreds, typically 400, 500, 600 questions a day. It might be the same question or versions of the same question over and over and over. But by the time they're 15 or 20, they tend to ask almost no questions to almost any person around them. Because they've decided that you're not supposed to ask questions. You know, another thing that happens between 5 and about 20 is the number of no's a person hears versus yeses, the number of can't do that, not possible versus can possible. The ratio is about 20 to 1. 20 to 1. So we start thinking like, I'm not supposed to ask questions, and it's not happening anyway. You know, where you know, all of us know this. If you have a 5-year-old anywhere in your life, they say, can we get ice cream? Right. And then they say, can we get ice cream? And then they say, mom, dad, grandma, can we? And then they say, right after soccer, can we get, if I eat all my dinner, can we get ice cream? Like, they are persistent. They pursue a question. And a lot of us, we stop pursuing great questions. You know, and that's one of the things we found over and over, the most creative people, they tend to pursue great questions. And it's something that you can do intentionally. It's something you can practice. It doesn't mean you have to start with a great question. Like, for example, I'm a dad, right? I have 2 teenage daughters. And I could say, like, what are we doing this weekend? That's not a great question. Mm-hmm. But if I say, are there things we could do this weekend that we would all love and look forward to? That's a better question, right? If I say, well, what are some things we might be able to do this weekend that would be, like, unbelievably memorable? It's a completely different question, right? A lot of people say, what are we doing with the summer? What are we doing over summer? You know, but if you change that and you say, what could we put into the summer schedule that all of us would be like, we'd want to talk about for the next 2 months leading up to the summer because we'd be so excited about it. It's just a different question, you know, and the 5-year-olds, they tend to pursue a question they're really interested in.
Yeah.
And sometime between 5 and 20 or so, we stop pursuing questions. We start saying, what do I have to do? What do I have to do?
Would you say that that's just all learned behavior? Because I feel like we're hesitant to change and employ new ideas in our lives. And I think a little bit of that is just past experience. Like, I used to have a boss, I'm not going to say his name, but I'd come to him with an idea and I'd say, we should try this. And he'd go, no, it doesn't work. And I'd be like, well, why? And he's like, I tried that 20 years ago. It didn't work. And it's like, okay, but we could work on it, you know, like, it doesn't have to be the exact same. And also the time and place is different. So do we just limit ourselves because of past experience, or is it something completely different?
That's a big part of it. And it's also reality. You know, we also, you know, when we're 5, we don't know that certain things are not possible, because certain things are not. Like, I'm not going to live on Pluto for a couple of years, you know, like, that's not happening. We tend to, Mark Twain had this great line. He said, when a cat sits on a hot stove, right, it'll never sit on a hot stove again in its life, but it'll also never sit on a cold stove. Mm-hmm. And he said, he followed that by saying, we have to be careful not to take more wisdom out of an experience than is actually in there. You know, and we do that. Our brains say, that hurt, that didn't work, that was, that didn't happen. I wasn't able to make it happen. And we tend to say, all right, I'm not doing that or anything remotely similar to that again. You know, and it's, some of it's the world around us. So some of it's just bumping into reality, but some of it, a lot of it is self-imposed.
So then the big question is, how do we use this creativity in our day-to-day lives, in our interpersonal relationships, in our financial lives, in our business lives? How do we make them more meaningful and more open to these ideas?
Yeah, yeah. So we found five things that the most creative people tended to have in common. One of them was they pursued better questions. The second one is they expected to find an answer. And if they didn't think there was an answer, if they didn't have that level of expectancy or belief, they tended to do things to feed a belief. You know, like very often they would get small victories. They would find ways to get a little win. Like, for example, everybody I know is in a lot of meetings. They spend a lot of time in meetings. And I challenge them all the time. I call it the four halves meeting challenge. I say, take one of the meetings you go to regularly, you know, and it could be dinner with family, right? It could be all kinds of things, but make it four halves, right? Make it twice as engaging, twice as effective, and half as long. You know, and this concept of building belief or building expectation, even if it's a little tiny win at a time, it might mean you take that one interaction, you say, I'm going to hang out with one of my friends this weekend. How do I make it a little more engaging? Maybe not twice as engaging, but is there some topic that my friend would love talking about? You know, or is there some different place we could go that would make it just much more engaging? Or is there some memory we could be like, hey, remember the last time we did that? You know, that would make it significantly more engaging. And the most creative people, they tend to do things that feed this belief or this expectation. Mm-hmm. You know, they win the momentum game of it's possible.
Yeah, I think that's a big thing is believing that it's possible before you start probably creates more of a follow through then is what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, you have your guitar behind you, right? Yeah. And we were talking about that guitar, right? When you first pick up an instrument, it's like, I'm not going to play the hardest song in history, but can I figure out this one little chord or this one little combination or the intro to a song I really like? And can I get decent at that the first, you know, the first 10 seconds of a song I really like?
Yeah.
And you do it a couple times and you go, all right, I got the first two notes. You know, but then you get the first two and the third one and you start thinking like, I could probably play the song.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
I did exactly that when I picked up a guitar. I learned the intro to Stairway to Heaven and I was like, I can play guitar if I can play this, you know? And you just saying that it's the creating more achievable things, like the better questions and an expected answer with the expected answer, are we creating more manageable expectations with that? So it's more baby steps.
Yeah, sometimes it's baby steps. Yeah, yep, yep. What we saw is a lot of times the question will evolve from what if or wouldn't it be amazing if to how could that happen? Like I had a friend years ago, he was playing professional baseball in Tuscany, in Italy. And he says to me, like I played college baseball. He says, Fanning, you got to get over here and help me coach, because he was a player and a coach. He was the best hitter in the country of Italy for like a decade. And he's like, you got to get over here and help me coach this team. And I kept saying, yeah, sure. Sounds good. Of course, who wouldn't say, yeah, sure. Sounds good. And he says, all right, give me a date. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't have a date. He's like, you need to come for at least a month. Otherwise you won't have an impact on the team. Like you got to stay with me for a month. And I'm like, maybe soon. And finally he's like, best time is this time. There's a tournament going on then too. And I'm like, oh, so what I did is I put a stake in the ground. I bought a plane ticket, well, a round trip ticket. And I said, I'm coming for a month and I have no idea how am I going to figure it out from a work perspective, from any perspective, but I took one step, mm-hmm. you know, and very often, yes, it's chunking it down. It's like, I write books, right? I've written a couple books. Everywhere I go, I meet someone that says, Jonathan, I want to write a book. And they're like, what do you recommend? I said, well, write one page. That's going to go in your book. One story that's going to go in your book. One lesson or one aha moment or one funny thing that you want to put in the book. And then send it to me. And they're like, oh, that's it? I'm like, no, that's not the end. That's the beginning. You know, but we need to trick our brains, right? This process of becoming less creative, it took us 20, 30, 40 years to become less creative. Mm. And we're not going to win the battle overnight. You know, it's going to be an intentional process, you know, and not everybody loves that, but it's like my brother-in-law and I were traveling recently and he's like, let's do 100 push-up a day challenge while we're traveling. I'm like, sure. Sounds good. You know, drop into 100 push-ups. He's like, no, you don't have to do 100 at once. You got to do 100 in the day.
Yeah.
So if that means one and you're doing 100 times, you're, you know, every 5 minutes, you're like, all right, I do one more push-up. He's like, you start where you start. But within a few days, you're like, wow, I can do three times as many in each little set that I could do in the beginning of this journey. And that's the process of unleashing your creativity again.
That's great. What can I ask, what inspired you to share this? Why did you become so passionate about creativity?
Because it's a lid, you know, because it's such a lid. I see so many people. I do a lot of work with big companies, and I do a lot of leadership work. And I see so many people that have this potential that's untapped, you know, and I try to figure out what happened that all of a sudden, like somehow they're in this spot where they're okay. They're settling. They're okay with okay. You know, and they've got this amazing untapped potential that they might not even see. And it just started to bother me. And we all have it. We all have things like that we could be doing that we're not. And I started asking the question, like, how do you unleash that in a better way?
Yeah. Again, I'm talking to Jonathan Fanning, author of the book Creativity Unleashed. Jonathan, first of all, I really appreciate you having come on to share all these things. Like, I consider myself a creative person, and you've given me things to reconsider. Especially I'm in my 40s, and that it kind of wanes over time, right? You start to believe that this is what you are, and just opening up your mindset to there's other possibilities, better questions, better approaches. What other things do you think we should know that we haven't talked about?
Yeah. So another thing we found that the most creative people do is they tend to be idea sponges. You could call them professional noticers. Like, they go out of their way to collect ideas, experiences, perspectives. And I like to call it, ultimately, they collect options. They collect options that might fit somewhere in this thing they're trying to create, even if they don't know what the thing they're trying to create is yet. You know, they tend to be like, they when they're somewhere, they like to notice things and think about the things that they notice. You know, and they put these things almost in their back pocket. You know, for example, I'm a dad. I have two teenage daughters. And when I was 15, my father hands me a book. And it's a book about a basketball player. And I was a basketball nut at the time, played high school and college basketball too. And he didn't say, read the book. He gave me a book that he knew I would read. Like, the guy had won an NBA championship the year before, and MVP and all this. And I'm like, I'm reading that book. My father didn't say, 15 minutes a day, I want you to read. I want you to write about it. I devoured the book, you know, and at the end of the book, the author, the player says, when he was in high school, his coach told him, look, you could be out on the driveway practicing, out in the playground practicing 2 hours a day. Somebody's practicing 2 or 3 hours, 2.5 hours, 3 hours a day. He said, you could be dribbling it a million times with your left hand a day, and somebody's dribbling it a million and one. You could shoot 500 free throws a day, somebody's shooting 600. And his coach, when he was a teenager, said, someday you're going to play that guy. How do you think it's going to go? And it was one paragraph. I reread the paragraph. I put a bookmark in the book, and I went out on the driveway, and my work ethic in basketball never the same. You know, and what my father did, and I don't even know if it was very intentional, but was he used a resource to teach me and motivate me, right? And the most creative people tend to be collectors of ideas like that, you know. And I started digging into that, and I found out that Phil Jackson, when he was coaching the Bulls, Michael Jordan, and when he was coaching the Lakers with Kobe and Shaq, Phil would give each of his players a different book every year at Christmas time. He'd say, here's 12 books, not the same book. Like, his book for Dennis Rodman was not the same as his book for, you know, Scottie Pippen or Shaquille O'Neal or Kobe Bryant. And what he did is he used a resource to challenge, to motivate, to inspire, to facilitate accountability, you know, to take them to the next level. And the most creative people, they tend to collect ideas like this and say, wow, what's a tool like that that I could use? You know, so I coach travel soccer, you know, and I don't give the kids books, because I sit there and I think, if I give them a book, they're not reading it probably. But I give them a picture of one little story from one book, you know, or a video from somewhere. And I'm like, oh, you'll love this clip of, you know, Rose Lavelle practicing juggling when she was 12, you know, and the kids watch it and they're like, what? Are you kidding me? And their work ethic changes, you know, and it comes from collecting ideas, perspectives, experiences, options. You know, if one of the things you want to do is motivate people, you're constantly an idea sponge for, like, what motivates me? What do I notice in the world that's motivating other people? You know, and it facilitates, it's a spark for taking your creativity to the next level.
Yeah. And if people wanted to learn more, they could read your book, Creativity Unleashed. Or are there any other resources that you would suggest that people use to implement these ideas?
Oh, a lot. Yeah. Yeah. We do a lot of videos for one, and usually a lot of challenges. So if they find me online, jonathanfanning.com, you know, or Google or YouTube or whatever. But I love biographies and autobiographies, because you pull out stories from people's lives and you say, wow, that gives me something. You know, like, for example, I read probably 15 books about Walt Disney's life a couple of years ago. And one of the things that just jumped out at me was when he was, I think he was 8 years old, and one of their neighbors was a retired doctor. And this doctor paid Walt Disney a quarter to draw his horse. And Walt Disney, at the age of eight, it was this eye-opening experience, because he said, what, you can get paid to do art? Mm. You know, and Walt Disney never saw the world the same after that one experience. You know, and I personally love biographies for that, you know, digging into, because you'll see yourself in the story somehow, some way, somewhere.
Oh, yeah. I've read a lot of biographies myself, and every single time you kind of put yourself in their shoes. It's an excellent point. Mm-hmm. And I think I always came away with something like a new view on how I could be living my life. Jonathan Fanning, author of the book Creativity Unleashed, and your website is jonathanfanning.com.
That's it. You got it, Neil.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me and having this conversation.
Oh, you bet. Yeah, great to be with you. Thanks for doing what you do.
Yeah, and thank you for listening. Conversations is a public affairs program of the station.